The morning I drove down from San Francisco, the weather was foul. A curtain of cold rain fell from a gunmetal gray sky. I'd set up a meeting with Sheriff Hartley in Carmel to discuss the Ellen Court situation. I didn't expect much cooperation from him, but it was worth a try, a way to begin. When I pulled up in front of Hartley's office, the sky had begun to clear and the sun was breaking through. I hoped it was a good omen.
I'm Sam Pancake, and welcome back again to Sam Pancake Presents the Monday Afternoon Movie. And my guest today is Lucas Zachary Hazlett, who I know as, I've known him for a few years. We do the Gale together at Growlings. He's an amazing improviser, actor, and comedian. And Lucas, thank you for coming on today.
Thank you for having me. You already took the introduction right out of my mouth, so great.
I was trying to help.
There was so much pressure put on me about how to introduce myself, and you nailed it.
And I did the thing I usually do where, like, I don't tell you, but I change everything, but I don't tell you before I do it. I'm great. But tell us some of your big credits.
Oh, boy. The biggest one, hopefully comes out in 2019, is a show on Lifetime called American Princess, where I play a Renfaire actor who goes by the name of Stick and only says the word Stick while performing in the Renfaire. I've guested on Wrecked, Two Broke Girls, Superior Donuts, blah, blah, blah.
You've been around.
I've been around, yeah.
But you're so young and fresh. So thank you for joining me today, Lucas. I picked the Norlis tapes for you. Not specifically about anything having to do with you. I just thought it was something I didn't know, and we could explore this together. It first aired on February 21st, 1973 on CBS. And this was a creation of the man named Dan Curtis, who gave us Dark Shadows, the movie Burnt Offerings, Trilogy of Terror, another classic in the TV movie horror field. And he had also created this show. Have you ever heard of Night Stalker or The Night Strangler, Lucas? You're too young.
The actual guy? Richard Ramirez?
Well, not Richard Ramirez. Even before that, there was two TV movies starring Derry McGavin, the dad from Christmas Story, as a rumpled, scrumpled, like, investigative reporter for newspapers. And he was kind of broad and kooky, and in The Night Stalker, the first movie, which came out in 72, and I was obsessed with as a kid. He was investigating all these murders in Vegas, and it turned out to be a vampire doing it, and no one believed him, and he got kicked out of Vegas. And then there was a movie called The Night Strangler, where he's like, turns up in Seattle, and he's trying to investigate, I forget what it is, and there's like a werewolf, or it's murders, and it turns out to be something paranormal or supernatural. And then they made it a series, which only lasted for a season, but in my mind as a child, it lasted forever, because they used to rerun. Here's the thing, kids. Back when there were three networks, they reran everything all the time, so it felt like you were seeing it for fucking ever. So this movie, The Norlis Tapes, was Dan Curtis trying to recreate the success. This is a pilot.
Yes, it was. I'm glad you mentioned that. I was sitting on that piece of information. I was waiting, and again, you're really good at taking things right out of my mouth.
So could you, because I didn't tell you that, but you, how soon in did you realize, oh, this is a setup for a series?
Honestly, I looked it up on Wikipedia.
Oh, okay,
I did
okay.
Some research, but once I found that out, it became very obvious. I'm sure you'll talk about this in just a minute when we go through the actual movie, but they laid the premise on so fucking thick that they might as well have just looked to the camera and said, on the first episode of the Norlis Tapes. It was so obviously a setup for more episodes to come.
Yes, and it's written by a man named William F. Nolan, who wrote the movie Logan's Run, which is my favorite 70s. Yeah,
it's a pretty good one.
Sci-fi movie. Yeah. I was never a Star Wars kid or a Star Trek kid. I was very much a Logan's Run kid. And the story was by a man named, which was, it says story. I don't know if it was a novel or not. Maybe a short story, a man named Fred Mustard Stewart, which as a food named person, I can relate to.
Oh, yeah.
And
Mustard.
Mustard. His name is Fred Mustard Stewart. And my sister, who's a writer, is named Ann Stewart Pancake. So for hooray for foods and Stewarts.
Usually when something says story by, that just means they wrote the first draft.
That's true.
Seriously. In TV world, at least.
I feel like I saw somewhere that he maybe, or not, who knows? I'm sure you're right. It stars Roy Thinnes, who is an actor who's still alive, but he did a lot of work in the 60s and 70s. He was in another movie we covered on our Halloween episode, Horror at 37,000 Feet. He's on Satan's School for Girls, a movie we cover in this this season of my podcast. I think he's sexy as hell. No, your face is saying no.
I wasn't into him.
See, I weirdly am, and he's really not my type, but like, well, then we'll get back to him. But Angie Dickinson, who's amazing.
Well, yes. In this, no. But
well, nobody wins in this.
No one wins in this. I just got to say before we even get into it all together, I'm sorry. If you've ever seen The Police Squad,
yeah, yeah, right? Yes. Which, oh, yeah.
You know, is the precursor to the Naked Gun movies. This, in color. The way it was shot, the way it was scored, the way the actors behaved, this could easily have been an episode of Police Squad.
The dialogue
was such a...
Oh my God, it was just... So Angie Dickinson was in a series called Policewoman in the 70s, which was a very, like, hard-hitting drama about she's a policewoman named Pepper Monroe. And then she also was in Brian... She's been in tons of things, and she's a legend. She's also in Dressed to Kill, Brian De Palma's classic, where she gets slaughtered in an elevator, like, real soon into the movie, a la... Janet Leigh in Psycho. It's kind of...
Spoiler alert.
Well, it happened so fast, and it was came out in 1980.
Fair.
I didn't say who slaughtered her, and that would be the real spoiler, because it's a real switcheroo. Have you seen that movie, Dressed to Kill?
I have not.
Put it on your list. I'm telling all the young gays, put it on your list. Also, Claude Akins is the sheriff. He played the sheriff in everything. Yeah. And then Vanetta here's the thing. There are very few people of color at any of these movies. It's very sad.
Yeah.
Any of this genre. And in this one, we have Vanetta McGee, who was in Blackula, for one
which
thing.
Which I love.
Oh, it's William Marshall.
I love that movie.
King of Cartoons, yeah. Also in Pee Wee.
Yes, yes, yes.
And she, I used to get her, and it even acknowledges this in her Wikipedia, she was often confused with Lynette McKee, who was, they look similar. And Lynette McKee is still with us. Sadly, Vanetta's not anymore. And she was in The Cotton Club, and she was more of a singer. Mm. Don Porter, who plays his publisher, who also played Gidget's dad in the series Gidget, played by Sally Field. Mother of Sam Greisman, the guest on my holiday episode. See, talk about conspiracy theories as we were before. And then a woman named Michelle Carey, who plays his sister, who we'll get to later. And then Herd Hatfield, who is an older character actor who we'll also get to later. Okay, movie opens sexy, to me, sexy brooding. Roy Thinnes is like in his glamorous San Francisco cliffside apartment. Oh, brooding, shirt open, showing off his 70s abs. And his gold necklace and his denim shirt's open. He's very troubled. He clearly he seems haunted. He's just like, the copy, I gotta say this, the copy on YouTube is not as clear as most copies of movies on YouTube. It looks like a moving impressionistic watercolor painting, and sometimes you can't even see the people's mouth moves. But we prevailed through it. Lucas, it didn't bother you.
It did not bother me, because I kind of knew from the opening scene that most of the things that were coming out of their mouths weren't that important anyway.
Doesn't matter. So he calls his publisher. This actor Roy Thinnes is really good at looking troubled and brooding, and like he's has you know these really haunted eyes. He's like, I can't finish my book because it was a book he was going to debunk the supernatural. He's like, it won't be ready. And the Don Porter's like, can't we meet tomorrow? And Norris is like, tomorrow may be too late. But they still set up a lunch, and he's right. He doesn't show up at the lunch.
The thing in this scene that two things immediately came to mind, just to really hammer home this point that this is the cheesiest 70s, like, dun, dun, dun. You're right. Opens on, he's brooding. The big thing I noticed, the page on the typewriter is blank.
Oh, right.
He hasn't even written a word. Oh. And he really goes in on that when the publisher's like, we're really excited for this book. And he's like, I haven't even written a word. And it's been a year. They've been waiting for this book for a full year.
What have you been doing? And so they can't find him. The publisher runs into, it's an attorney or someone.
His lawyer.
So Don Porter eventually goes to his house. There's a bunch of tapes, the Norlitz tapes. He rifles through them, and he puts in tape number one, i.e. episode number one. He puts it in, and then the tapes narrate the rest of the movie.
Yes.
Now, the way this differed from Kolchak is Kolchak was charming and rumpled, and like Darren McGavin can't not be broad if you've seen Christmas Story. He just is a little bit bigger than he needs to be, and he was like kind of, but like Roy Thinnes is very like chill and still and very contained and very like,
grounded?
Grave.
Even worse than grounded.
Grave. Gravitas.
Gravitas.
Yeah.
But performed in a whisper.
Exactly. It's very much whisper drama, which I sometimes am on those shows and I'm not great at them. But he, I read on IMDb, this is probably the reason it didn't take off, because he wasn't as engaging and involving as Kolchak was. Because he's just very much right here the whole time, and he doesn't have a whole lot of personality.
This whole thing began when my natural writer's curiosity was aroused by an article I'd read in a weekly periodical. The article was concerned with the commercial aspects of spiritualism and the occult. My original idea was to expose the phonies who were bilking millions of dollars each year out of their gullible victims, to go after the fake mediums, phony astrologers, the self-proclaimed seers, and trick mystics. I was successful at this for some time. The floating face, which was a dummy's head on a wire, the ghost of a woman's son, who turned out to be the medium's own kid in a weird getup, the fortune teller whose life images in a crystal ball were supplied by a hidden film projector. But then I got into this business with Ellen Court.
Norris talks about he's out to expose the fake psychics and mediums and the child who comes back to life, but it's really the fortune teller's son dressed in a sheet or some shit. And then he met up with Ellen Court, played by Angie Dickinson. She tells him a story. I'm at my mansion one night. My dog hears something.
Bark, bark.
I go to my giant gun cabinet. I pull out a rifle. I go to the studio / barn that was my husband's. He's dead now, P.S. Go to his studio. This person jumps out. Looks like Lurch from Adam's Family.
Very blue-faced.
Bluey purple.
So if there is a race of blue people out there, they are picketing this movie. He is in full-on blue face.
It's blue face.
So racist to the blues.
The blues. Can't get a break. So then the most troubling thing happens where his own... we don't know who it is yet. The German Shepherd jumps up. And PETA is not involved. There's no, like, animals were harmed of this.
He catches it and tosses the fucking dog out of the frame.
And it's a real dog.
Was it?
I don't know. It jumps, though.
I think they cut right at the moment when they toss, like, a fake dog. Because he tossed that way too easily.
I hope so, because it's really... It's hard to tell on the moving watercolor impressionistic version. So she shotgun blasts this creature. It disappears. We go back in the flashback. You know, he's there with her. She does all that stuff. And then she's revealing to Norlis. He was like, I went to the police. She's like, I went to the police. They didn't believe me. He's like, why not? She says, it's because he was my dead husband.
And this is the first moment in the movie when the horns kick in. She turns. Not only does she turn, she does the classic turns to the camera.
Yep.
Spikes the camera, looks directly into the audience,
right,
and
down
says,
the barrel.
It was Jim, my dead husband. Bum, 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 bum. And then cut to black. And it's just like, ugh.
And then we're back from commercial. And then she's like, he died of Pick's disease, which I looked up and is like a really severe and debilitating form of dementia, which seems way too depressing and upsetting for this creepy monster movie.
And it's called Pick's disease, like...
P-I-C-K.
So like... what's the it possessive like Jim Pick?
Yeah,
this was his like Parkinson's.
Doctor's Pick.
Doctor Pick's disease.
Exactly.
Oh my God.
Just like Alzheimer's and Heimlich maneuver and all of them. So he was involved in the supernatural. He knew he was going to die. He hooked up with this woman named Madame Jekyll. She's into the occult. She gave him a scarab ring from Osiris, which means the god of everlasting life. And he had there's a lot of information.
Mm-hmm.
He agreed with Madame Jekyll he would be buried with the ring in his coffin. And then for some reason, and he met Angie through her sister. So then they're having every office and every restaurant are high above the city.
It's the same restaurant.
For the lunch date with the lawyer.
Overlooking the Bay Bridge.
Same
corner. Always.
But this woman, God bless everybody, and she's not with us anymore. I looked her up.
I have voices like this. Scratchy, sexy baby.
She was awful.
She was terrible.
And she was like, I was estranged from my sister because James didn't like me, the husband. Just like, and she's, and it's just all so fantastic.
Actually, we haven't been close for over 3 years since she married that James Court.
Why? Did you get along with Court?
No, I didn't. And when Ellen married him, it affected our relationship. We just haven't seen very much of each other. And now when she really needs me, I can't be here.
How long do you have to be in New York?
Well, only a few days. But I felt that we should talk before I left. It's important. If she says that she saw James alive, well, then somehow...
Sure. If I didn't believe she was telling me the truth, as she knows it, I wouldn't be here.
I know, but it's just all so fantastic. I mean, how could such a thing be possible?
I don't know. But we're certainly going to try to find out.
And then so we have too much of her. Then there's a shopkeeper in Carmel. She gets the creatures in her back seat. She gets jumped. She wrecks her car. A truck driver finds her. All the character actors are 150%.
Yes.
They don't know if they're in Hee Haw, Sheriff Lobo, or... Because I keep thinking Claude Akins was Sheriff Lobo, but he wasn't Sheriff Lobo. That was another actor. Claude Akins was just a sheriff and everything else. He makes an appearance as a sheriff just to tell everyone, don't tell the town what really happened.
Because one thing about the police, I'm so sorry to have cut you off.
No,
right
no,
there.
Jump in anytime.
I have to say this about
say
the cops.
Everything, yes, say it.
Every single time they cut to the police arriving, it was either the same shot or the police in this part of Central California always drive in a straight line down a dark, windy road.
Yeah,
they just
the same
every
one.
Every single time the cops were coming, it was the same three cars, one after the other. A winding road, and I just
completely.
Like, oh my God.
And they're clearly setting up him to be the. He was also P.S. not really imaginative casting. He was also the sheriff, a different sheriff in all the Night Stalker movies and in the fucking Night Stalker series. And then he's on the golf course, which I thought the actor was Vic Morrow, who sadly died a few years later, but it's not him. They look like they're at like someone's house in like, I don't know, Toluca Lake, but they're at a golf course. And that's when he's the medical examiner and he tells the sheriff.
The cause of death was strangulation. But from the depth of the indentation marks in her neck, it seems that the murderer must have possessed exceptional strength.
Okay, I know she was strangled. What I want to find out is what else was done to her.
All right. That's the extraordinary part. The sallow skin cast and the collapsed sack-like appearance of the body was a direct result of a total evacuation of all the main arteries.
Oh, Sid, I...
Oh, all right. I'll make it simple for you. The girl's body was totally drained of blood.
It was... Look, I don't want the media to get a hold of this. That's all I need, a bunch of newspaper men crawling up my back. Now, I can
Tom.
See the headlines now. Vampire killer loose in Monterey. Tom. What can you do for me?
I'll do the best I can, but I can't guarantee anything. You know that I have to file a report. I cannot falsify the report.
Well, you know damn well I don't want you to do anything like that. All I want kept under wraps is the condition of the corpse, not the fact that she was murdered. Look, I gotta have time to work this thing out.
Okay, I understand. I'll try and keep it under wraps for you.
Okay. That's one favor I owe you.
All her blood was drained out of her, this woman in the car, who also, whenever she gets scared by a cat and her arms go like this, it's like the cat has a gun.
There were so many
I'm
physical
above my
and
head.
Vocal choices
so
in this movie that
many.
Were just questionable. I literally, now after seeing a movie like this, every audition I go on where a casting director tells me, too broad, I go, nah, I see what has made it to TV. I'm going to make my choices.
Keep going. I'm in Hee-Haw now.
I'm in Hee-Haw land.
Anyway, Norris goes to the sheriff. There's another gun rack. It's not locked. And then he's like, we need to investigate this. And the sheriff's like, no, nothing bad happened. And then he goes up and reaches for the gun off the rifle rack. And that's when the sheriff jumps up like he's going to shoot him. Also, they're not locked. They're not behind glass. And anyone, including Norris, can grab a rifle in the police station off the wall. Then there's this long, winding narration with him talking about the beauty, lush scenery, the greenness of Monterey and driving up.
As I headed for the court estate along the 17-mile drive, acres of lush cypress and tall pine loomed over me. The ocean below bellowed and roared, smashing into the coastline, spilling white foam along the sand. There's no doubt this rugged peninsula country could give the French Riviera tough competition. But on this afternoon, my mind really wasn't on the scenery. I kept thinking about the girl who had been murdered the night before, trying to tie what I knew about her into the story Ellen had told me. I had a gut hunch the two were connected. How, I didn't know. But I was going to have to try and find out.
And it's a beautiful drive. And he's got a Corvette Stingray, an orange Corvette Stingray. He's got the classic 70s signature car, like how Sabrina had that Mustang on Charlie's Angels, and Rockford Files had something that he drove that I don't remember because I'm far too young and I never watched Rockford Files. So then he's going to talk to Angie again. He goes up to the estate. It's gigantic.
Huge. Xanadu-esque.
It is Xanadu-esque. Xanadu. It's beautiful. I'm sure it's up there somewhere. She lives alone. She's had to let the servants go. The husband died. The maid won't come back since the shopkeeper died in a car accident. That doesn't make any sense. So they take her up to the weird thing. So he talks to Angie. He's like, let's talk about this. At no point does he lech out on her, which is very unusual for these movies. Like we covered in the first season, The Curse of the Black Widow, James Franciscus plays this investigator and he hits and leches and ogles every single woman that crosses his path. And it's all creepy. But fucking Roy Thinnes is so tight with his emotions. And again, I'm attracted to him. I'm like, oh, he's gay. That's what it is. He's in love with me.
Is he gay in real life? Or
No. He was married to his wife in The Horror at 37,000 Feet. I'm looking at my producer. But he's straight.
Oh.
Sadly. He's still alive. He's like 80. So they go to the studio. She retells the story about the ring. Then about what happened, she shows him specifically. We go through the whole goddamn thing. Here's the dog's blood. Here's where I shot him. He disappeared. They go to the mausoleum on this date. Now, I grew up on a family estate, and we did have a family graveyard. We did not have a crypt or a mausoleum. And then we had another plot in town because there were a lot of pancakes that went back many, many centuries in West Virginia. But never in my life have I seen, say it.
I just want to get this joke out of the way. When a bunch of pancakes die, do they stack the bodies?
Dun, 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 dun. I have to say, I always want to say I've heard them all before. I've not heard that.
Thank you.
Well, the bodies are not stacked. They're leveled up. But in this mausoleum, they go to the fucking crypt, and it just slides open.
Slides open. Never has stone moved so easily.
Just with a handle as if for that purpose. Why would that be? It makes no sense, and it's not addressed. They slide it open, and there's her dead purple-blue husband. She doesn't have much of a reaction to it. He's wearing the blue glowing ring. I don't understand why they're not more freaked out.
I don't know.
She's like, he got the ring from this Langdon guy. They go to the gallery, this older gay man. Now, Herd Hatfield, the actor who plays this man, is most famous for playing Dorian Gray in the 1945 version of The Picture of Dorian Gray.
Oh.
And I looked him up, and he was a gay guy.
Okay.
Which you kind of believe.
Yes.
In real life, I mean. And he apparently lived the rest of his life being mad he was Dorian Gray, which, get over it, you had a career, stop it. And that's when he fills Norlis in on, he's like, are you interested in the occult? And he's like, no, I'm not. I have no interest in that. And I was James's gallerist, but he was going crazy. And because of his disease, which was dementia, it would help if they just said he had dementia.
He had dementia.
They would add more of an element.
His liver wasn't failing.
Exactly,
He didn't have pancreatic cancer.
Yeah, exactly.
He was crazy.
Yeah, exactly. And not in control of it. So Langdon drops the info that Madam J. Keel gave him the ring. Langdon wanted to own the ring. Why did you want it? Well, I just like occult items. He was like, he was kind of creepy. He's Langdon. He wants to know about the ring. Norlis tells him it's on the man still in the family crypt. Cut to immediately. Somehow that old man is going from San Francisco to Monterey in the pouring rain by himself, climbing up a hill on this woman's estate. He slides open the crypt. It's guess what?
A gay man who wants a piece of jewelry. Yes. Neither rain nor sleet nor snow.
No. And he literally gets killed off so fast. He pulls it back. There's Court jumps in and goes, wow. He roars him
he
to
roars.
Death. He literally goes, wow. And then cut to commercial. Then Norlis. They're clearly setting these people. I thought they were setting them up to recur in the series, but they all get killed, so no. Then he goes and confronts Madame Jaquille, who's the beautiful Vanetta McGee.
She's gorgeous.
She's got this chic red outfit on. She's got this feather in her hair, red feather. She's got feather earrings. She has really beautiful cornrow situation. And she's like, finally, she's like, stay away from the estate because it's now the House of Sargoth. But she kind of explains it. So it turns out James Court thought if he wore this. Okay, let me just try to get back to the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
He goes to Jaquille. She has a short bit. And she's like, stay away. It's the House of Sargoth. So he goes back. He gets Angie. They go back to the studio. He gets the rifle from the gun rack. They go in. There's a new sculpture.
Yeah.
What does it look like?
It's a giant demon with it made out of blood clay.
But I kind of was attracted to it. It has full abs, babe.
You know what? Even in the 70s, they were ab queens.
They were abs. It looks kind of like Lou Ferrigno in The Hulk.
Oh, okay.
It looked like Red Hulk. Kind of.
It does because of what happens later.
Exactly.
Yes, that's
okay.
True. Yes, yes,
all right.
Yes.
So he takes, Norlis takes a clay sample. Court, the dead husband jumps out all blue out of nowhere.
Wait a second. He opens up There's tunnels of some shit going on in this.
Well, they find out. Yeah.
There's like secret tunnels leading from all kinds. I'm like, what in the world?
Exactly. Well, we kind of find that out. I forget how we find that out, but like, Court jumps out. They shoot him again. He chases them. He pulls the door off the Mercedes. They get away from him. And he you can tell, okay, he was played by an actor named Nick Dimitri, who played lots of wrestlers and bodybuilders, and he was a stuntman.
Okay.
And his go-to position is like the wrestling, like, he like crouches down, and they go to the sheriff. They don't believe him. And he's like,
"Listen, all you know, it's 2 o'clock in the morning. You've been drinking.
Look, I'm not going to argue with you. I saw Court. He was as close to me as you are.
Another one of your ghosts?
A ghost doesn't rip off a car door. Take a look out the window.
A ghost doesn't rip off a car door. Maybe a ghost can. We don't know.
No ghost I've ever encountered would be so cruel to a car door.
And yes, well, I guess not. And then the sheriff's like, he doesn't want any more of it. And he does this line reading, "I'm going to give up on this wild goose chase."
That's wild goose chase.
Oh, my God. I'm so glad you brought that up. As an actor, I'm really, really concerned with what words you are supposed to hit in a line.
Yeah.
And I don't know in what, first of all, in the audition, from the audition to the rehearsals to the table read to the dailies, in what world do you hear the line read "goose chase" and you choose that? It's goose chase.
A wild goose chase.
A wild goose chase. Not a wild goose chase.
Wild goose chase.
Wild goose chase.
I literally thought about this way too much too as an actor. Here's what happened. They did that take maybe twice, maybe three times. Let's face it, we're on a 2-week schedule. I think he did that thing where, like, just to mix it up in one of them, it came out of his mouth weird, or he just was trying to be trying to make a different choice. It doesn't matter.
There's no choice. Here, we got to just break this down real quick, because like, that bothered the shit out of me. There's only three words: wild, goose, and chase. If you emphasize wild, then there could be a tame goose chase. There could be a normal goose. If you emphasize goose, it could be a wild goose chase, meaning, okay, there could be wild dog chases.
Or wild ducks.
But wild goose, what else? If you emphasize chase as if there could be a different word there. It's not wild goose chase. We knew it was a chase when you said wild and goose. So why'd you emphasize chase?
It's really, look it up, people. It's very satisfying and upsetting all at the same time. Then we go into a complete comedy fucking segment. This comic interlude starts where the sister Marcia comes down. It's raining and she can't get in the house because they've been estranged. She doesn't answer the phone. Angie's not there. She's going to stay in the inn in town to feel safe or whatever. She goes to this like hotel out of some sort of 30s Ma and Pa Yoakum, Mammy Yoakum comedy. Two actors they were in everything in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. This guy's name is Brian O'Byrne, who's like, he's also in Curse of the Black Widow. Whoever think he played was like this. And the woman, Jane Dulow, is the actress. She was a reliable battle axe in everything she was in. And they got their own show going on.
Yes, they do.
And the sister has this, like, for no reason, this big transparent umbrella that says New York on it. It's like, which is, I used to covet those clear umbrellas in the 70s, but then why does it say New York on it?
So many questions.
She's like, I need a room. No, actually, her voice goes away. She doesn't have the crazy, sexy, grouchy
she
baby
can't
voice.
Have the crazy voice because the guy's holding down the crazy voice. Like he sounded like an off-brand Jerry Lewis, and it was just like, I can't deal with this interlude.
And they call each other mom and pop, and she's like, no, we can't rent any more rooms.
I said we're closed.
Can't turn the girl away, Mama. No harm in giving her 9.
Well, give her the key and hurry up about it and come to bed, Papa. Now.
Mama, she gets a little grouchy after midnight. I can handle her, though.
Well, I hope so. I don't want to cause you any trouble.
Oh, no trouble at all. Now, let's see. That will be $10. Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
You with your thing?
No, thank you. I can manage.
Pleasant dream.
So they don't know what movie they're in. No one told them what movie they're in. And so she gets a room. Her hair gets bigger and bigger throughout. She's combing it, the sister, and her hair gets bigger. She turns on the shower. You think it's going to be a psycho situation. Mm-hmm. She looks very sexy. She's very beautiful. Her cheeks have like, it was that moment in the 70s where like the rouge went from just below the eyes to the jawline, all smeared down the side. I remember my grandmother rocking that for a few years. So she goes to the window. She goes to the window. I thought it was going to be a fake out. She opens the curtains. Not a fake out.
Not a fake out. He's just there.
Her brother-in-law, who hates her, jumps, like, clearly, I guess there was a trampoline, jumps through the window.
Well, first, before he jumps, though, she pulls the curtain back, and normally in all those 70s movies where that gag exists, they're in attack mode. He's just chilling there, being waiting, like, waiting for the moment that she's gonna pull the curtain. No fear in his eyes, no attack mode. He just was like, oh, shit, that's my cue.
And he's wearing the same exact demon contact lenses that in the, another movie we cover this season called The Summer of Fear that the witch in those were. Same ones that were passing around Hollywood. So she snatches her. Goober Grandpapa goes in and goes like, what's going on in here? Woo! And they cut to commercial. It's so Mammy Yoakum. It's delicious and horrible. And then they go back. The cops are there. They're everywhere. And then he says, he knocked me off and he carried her off into the woods. And then he's like, describe him. He says everything but the fact that he's blue. He's like, he had wild eyes. And then,
he was wearing a suit that 1930s Ferragamo in his shoes. The most magical shoes I've never seen. What color was he? Oh, I can't remember. He was blue, you fucking asshole.
I looked right into his crazy eyes, but I didn't see his skin somehow. And then there's this whole moment where they go to him and the Papa motel owner goes like, I have one question for you, Sheriff. What?
What do I do if he comes back?
They do a comedy sting that's out of place with the entire rest of the movie. He's so annoying. Then, oh my God, back to Norlis and Angie. They talk. That's where he's found out the tunnels are underneath. There was bootleggers. Tunnels go to the studio and the crypt. He's also a chemical engineer because he scraped some clay.
That's right.
And found out that's 40% human blood. In his home chemistry set, somehow. Aye. Who needs a medical investigator? He's an alchemist. Then Angie's at the end. She turns around. Madame J. Keel, who doesn't have supernatural powers, appears in her room.
I've got to talk to you.
And then she's like, I can't do this anymore. She tells the whole story about the ring is supposed to bring eternal life. He wanted to be buried with it because he made a deal with this demon Sargoth that if he made the statue of the demon Sargoth, that he would have eternal life after he died. Because Sargoth would come over and take over the world. He just had to, like, kill people and put after he died and put the human clay. And the ring is the thing keeping him to... The ring allows him to rise from the grave after his death. I'm reading off my notes now because it's a very important information. And complete the sculpture of Sargoth so the demon Sargoth could enter our world and court would be granted immortality. And it's delivered very matter-of-factly. Like, here's the thing. He went to get the newspaper. He actually got milk and cigarettes instead. He came back to the house. And Angie... And then they're both like, well, let's go back and find him.
Yeah, we got to get that ring.
Because they get the ring off his finger. They go back. They go in the tunnels. Norlis is chasing up to find them in his red-orange Corvette Stingray. He gets behind a car for a long time. Which serves no purpose other than just to delay him.
Yes, of course.
And have a fun chase scene, because you think it's going to be a devil inside of it. But it is beautiful country. I've never been up to Monterey, have you?
I have not.
Okay. He covers some of the same territory, I think, that Nicole Kidman and Reese Witherspoon drive through in Big Little Lies. That's my only...
Although, in Big Little Lies, Monterey looks gorgeous.
It does.
That area looks very beautiful. Yeah. But it's not the same cinematographer that was working on the Norlis Stage. Let's put it that way.
I don't think so at all. Then things really pick up. Because at the beginning of this movie, I was kind of like, this isn't nearly as campy and wacky and out there as a lot of these that I've covered. Mm-hmm. Chiefly because that long opening with him, like, milling about his gorgeous apartment. Also, I forgot to say later, the phone's ringing. He's just laying in bed with his shirt open and his tiger skin rug and his clothes everywhere. I'm like, this is more like some sort of like sensual Burt Reynolds situation. But then later, especially now, things really pick up. It goes right into Cuckooville. The ladies go down the tunnels and Madame Jekyll is just telling her what to do. She's like, where do I go? She's like, go over there. We have to split up. So somehow they find this giant other coffin down the tunnels. They open it up. The dead husband's inside, blue with the ring. He wakes up, grabs both of them, and then Angie beats him with a flashlight
and runs away.
And he hugs Madame Jekyll. The last we see her, eyes are open. Angie gives up on her. And then later on, she's like, oh, she's dead.
She's dead.
She's
that
dead.
That pissed me off so much.
It's infuriating.
But before she gets, like, hug killed.
Yes.
For maybe, and you know, TV time is a premium.
Yeah.
You can't waste too much time on something. She is trying to take this goddamn ring off this dude's finger for about 3 minutes. And I'm just like, just rip the finger off or something. Like, she won't take it off. And then nothing specifically
and
triggers.
And yells at her.
Yells!
She's like, get it off, get it off. I'm trying.
Nothing specifically triggers the guy to wake up. Nothing. He just randomly wakes up and then eat hugs her.
And then she's running through, Angie is, because she's left Madame J. Kilford. I was bummed because you think he's setting up, Dan Curtis, the creator, is setting up maybe Madame J. Kilford to be like the woman that Norlis goes to and he has to find out about an occult thing. And then there's diversity in the cast, you know, and of course it's an exotic person of color. Or the old gay man who's like, maybe that's going to be a running character. No, he's dead already. He's dead. Because Angie's running through the tunnels, leaves Jaquiel for dead, away from her dead husband who's blue. She falls down on top of Langdon's body and then her dead sister's body. And she screams like you're supposed to, but not that much.
No, yeah.
She doesn't seem that concerned.
She gave a 14-hour day scream where it's like, this was the martini shot. And just like, oh, and we gotta go. I'm tired.
I want literally my martini. And then Court appears and he groans at her, the husband. And then finally Court comes back and she says, he killed Marcia and Jaquiel too. No, you could have helped Jaquiel.
Yeah, Jaquiel was
absolutely
sacrificed.
Exactly. The last time we saw her, because I thought she was going to rise from the dead and help and be like the last minute Hail Mary. Nope. They go back to the studio. The sexy sculpture is there. It's at one point we learn that everything's done except for its eyes. So they're in the studio. Who pops out of the goddamn window seat?
We can't let him come to life.
Blue Boy himself, like in his Frankenstein lurch from Adam's family. This is how they buried him? Like, pops back up. He Frankensteins over. Frankenstein's monster.
Thank you for clarifying.
Over. You're welcome, horror people. He finishes. It took my second viewing to realize he's finishing eyes.
Yeah, took me a couple minutes to realize that.
With his big clumsy monster hands, but he's still a talented sculptor.
Oh, you skipped a very important part. By this point, Norlis has created a blood circle.
Oh, that's right. Shit.
A blood circle around the statue that he says some wackadoo line where he's like,
I wrote it down.
You wrote the line down? Yeah. Read the line.
Angie's all like, what are you doing? He says, I'm making a blood circle.
According to medieval alchemy, you can enter a blood circle, but if it's on fire, you can't get out.
You can enter a blood circle, but if it's on fire, you can't get out. Okay.
That's the thing about these supernatural and horror movies. Like, and I was on Charmed. I was on Angel. I've done these things where, like, I remember doing a sidebar about me doing Charmed. I was a demon, sure. An assistant demon, of course, to sexy Chris Sarandon. Oh. And I had to cast a spell. Ooh. And they had this weird Latin-ish spell thing. And I said to the script supervisor, oh, can you tell me what this means so I really can put some meaning? She's like, laughed in my face and said, no one cares what that means.
Wow.
And that's the thing about these things. You can make up your own mythology, demonology, rules, which is fun to work with, but like it's a real convenience in a script.
Yeah.
Which makes the stakes, I don't know, because in a lot of these supernatural things, it's like someone's killed, but they can come back later. So what are the stakes?
If you're writing, this is just a little writing tip for all of our listeners.
Yes, please.
There. If in the third act you introduce a deus ex machina like that, all you have to do is set it up in the first act. Just have a book. What's this book? Oh yeah, I wrote a book about blood circles. Just set it up in the beginning so that it's a payoff. There's a callback to it because it just felt like it came from nowhere.
Also, when he's first discovering the thing about that there was blood in the clay, then maybe he could have brought that up.
Of course,
he could have brought up the fact that he's a chemical engineer.
Yes.
and he knows about medieval alchemy, because before at the beginning he knows nothing about supernatural. He just wants to debunk it, and this is his first adventure. Because it's tape number one.
Holy. Oh, that's right. Good point.
Yeah.
Well, wait, didn't he say at the beginning that he started this so he could debunk?
Yes.
Okay, so if he went in, aha, okay,
boom.
We have found the flaw.
If
he went into the project to debunk the supernatural, then at no point did we see the turn where he went from this is all garbage. I mean, granted, a big blue man chasing you and eating people is a big turn, but to accept that the blood circle...
You're right. It's going to work.
He would have no reason to make that leap to think that would work.
Good point. So then like I said, Court then pops up out of the window seat.
Yes. What's a window seat? These are things?
They stand back to watch him wander into the blood circle as his big, like, clubby, like, little short black beetle boot situation goes over like that.
Oh, blood circle. I might as well go in there.
That's when he rubs the eyes and finishes them, and that's enough to make the demon complete. He starts to bellow and bray at the statue. It comes to life. There's an instant lightning storm. It comes alive. It can absolutely get it. I'm attracted to that demon statue.
I will agree with that.
All right? It starts to throw shit all over the place, including Court. It picks him up and throws him Hulk style.
That's another thing that I don't understand about supernatural movies is, and this happens a lot, actually, in all kinds of movies. The big bad creature that is like the... whatever the movie term is for like the thing that's you're trying to achieve always turns on the person that created it. Always.
Right, that got it there.
And
yes.
It's like, fuck that. No loyalty. None.
None. None. So he throws Court across the room. It's super strong. Norlis and Angie run out of the studio. The studio burns down very dramatically. They must have really put some effort and money into that burning because it lasts a good 2 or 3 minutes.
Too long. Oh my God.
A lot. So they finally, they reveal in the tape, Norla says they found the bones of James Court, or whatever his name was, but nothing of Sargoth, clearly setting it up that like Sargoth was the thing throughout. So then we're back in the room with the publisher, played by Don Porter, which sets up the series that there's David's disappearance, and maybe this will tell me why he disappeared. He pulls up tape number two. And then there's this weird like coda where it's just a flashback of all the exciting things. Was that on your version?
Yes.
There's just like a montage that was just to hype people up.
I think that was just a TV pilot type thing where you just, where the credits were about to roll. And so you just show what they just watched. Like that happened a lot in the 70s TV shows.
Yeah. But then it ends on like the big Quartz blue face with the demon eyes. And then his credit comes up starring, after all that, starring Nick Dimitri as James Court. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is the Norlis tapes, which luckily was not made into a series.
It was not picked up, but what year was that?
73? Yes, 73.
So 45 years later, or I guess 44, I don't remember how many seasons there have been of this show, but I could not help but notice that this should be made into a show now. Because the way you could sell it is very simple. It's X-Files meets 13 Reasons Why.
Oh, yeah.
That's what it is.
That's
a bunch
good.
Of tapes that have all this kind of cool info on it, and each tape reveals a new supernatural thing. You have investigators. I liked the idea. I hated the execution.
Well, Chris Carter acknowledges, I read this on IMDb, that this Kolchak was very much an inspiration in Norlis, too, for the X-Files.
Oh, awesome.
And actually, Darren McGavin and Roy Thinnes both played characters in the X-Files.
Did they really?
Yeah.
Okay, that's pretty goddamn cool.
And I watched the X-Files pretty religiously, but I don't remember specifically who they played, but I'm sure at the time I certainly probably recognized Kolchak because I was so... That was something that terrified me as a kid. I'm going to cover it in the next season, all the Kolchak movies. It terrified me and scared me so much as a kid. And I watched it recently, and it was like, I was a dumb kid. I was real dumb.
That's how I feel about the TV movie It.
Oh.
That scared the shit out of me. And now when I watch it, I'm like, the miniseries. I was like, what?
I never saw it. I didn't see it the miniseries for the first time until about 3 years ago, and it ain't good. I mean, Tim Curry's great.
Tim Curry is amazing. The part that, we're just talking about It now.
Sure.
The part that always got me is...
It fits the genre.
That's fair. It's a made-for-TV
miniseries.
I just always remembered I was 6 or 7 at the time. There was something about seeing the guy cut his wrists and bleed out and spell the word It with his blood that just made me go, I'm not going into the bathroom. Because I would see the streaks of water, and you know your brain as a kid. I would see it in water, and it freaked me out. Other than that, that movie's garbage. Absolute garbage.
It really is.
Blood freaks me out. But the cool thing about this, this thing, Norlis, why was all the blood in movies and TV at that era like
red paint,
hot pink paint?
I read,
like, what was that about?
In the Hammer movies from England, all those vampire Dracula movies, red paint. We covered in this season, The Devil's Daughter, where literally also there's a bowl of punch, like red punch, and then someone picks it up and throws a glass of it across at a portrait, and it turns into red paint. It's not supposed to. It's not like it's part of the magic. It just is red paint on the portrait. I've read somewhere at some point, and I don't remember specifics, but someone in the 70s or maybe early 80s, and there's some movie, which I also can't remember, sorry, we could look it up. We're like, oh, this person, this effects person on this movie invented the corn syrup red stuff that we see now. Because when you get that stuff in your mouth, sometimes it's sweet. The fake blood.
You know what? I recently watched that movie on Amazon, I believe. I forget what it's called, but it's like it came out right after Psycho. And it's when it's like in color and it's...
That didn't look like red paint.
No, this is the movie we're talking about, where it's like this is the first movie that had this hot pink,
syrupy stuff. Yeah, early 60s. But I'm talking about later on. Later on, like after the 70s, someone invented the one that looks more like actual like blood.
Okay.
Yeah, that's the one that was the corn syrup. Yeah, that it didn't look like ketchup. I almost called you Norless. I'm sorry.
It's a great name.
It ends with an S. It is a pretty great name.
Norless is pretty cool. Yeah. It sounds a little too much like Arliss.
That's true.
Which was, you know,
already
HBO
a TV show.
Great show.
Listen, Norless, I mean Lucas, thank you so much for doing this. Where can people find you on social meds?
I mean, as much as I would love everyone to follow me on Instagram, don't.
It gets real intense, y'all.
I really, you know.
It gets real dirty sometimes,
We could
too.
Start a whole nother show just about the pitfalls of how Instagram following bothers me.
But really does.
Yeah, Lucas Zachary Hazlitt. And in 2019, I will probably just be posting nonstop about this show, American Princess.
Yeah. Well, you're going to become more famous, so you need to
figure
it out.
More famous. Let's put it this way. I'm a series regular who is really just a recurring guest star.
All right, I'm Sam Pancake, in case you didn't know.
I thought we were doing that old radio thing. I'm Lucas Hazlitt.
You can. I'm at the Sam Pancake on Instagram, J Sam Pancake on Twitter. You can follow me, Sam Pancake, on Facebook. Everyone, thank you so much for listening to this, to the Norless Tapes. No. Thank you, everyone, for listening to this podcast. You can go to iTunes, rate, review, and subscribe. That really helps us out. Spread the word. Tell friends about it. Tell anyone you think might like this. And, I would say a little bit more about this movie, but you know what?
It's all just so fantastical.
You can subscribe to Sam Pancake Presents the Monday Afternoon Movie on iTunes, Spotify, or anywhere else you would listen to podcasts. Follow the Monday Afternoon Movie page on Facebook to get the latest updates about the show. This podcast is also on Twitter at Afternoon Movie. Do you have a memory of a made-for-TV movie you want to share? Please give us a call. Give us a call at 209-566-2253. That's 209-556-CAKE, C-A-K-E. See what we did there? Huh? And leave us a voicemail. We just might play it on a future episode of the show. Research for this show is done by me, Sam Pancake. It's produced by Drew Mackey and edited by Dax Schaefer. This is a Table Cakes podcast. Table Cakes is a woman-owned, Los Angeles-based podcast network, and you can find out about our other shows on this network at tablecakes.com. To support Monday Afternoon Movie and our other shows, go to patreon.com/tablecakes.